I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of native people is going to occur. Krejci now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for long-term memory radio. A four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory radio.
In 1884, the federal government of Canada asserted that they aimed to, quote, make Indians white men in the eyes of the law, end quote. Fast forward to 2002, and some would say that little has changed. The current federal government will be seeking to replace the Indian Act with the First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act. While the Canadian government is seeking final solutions to unresolved Aboriginal treaties and other issues, the lack of consultation with Natives and the focus on passing federal legislation leave some asking, are First Nations ready for the drastic redefinition of their rights and powers as this country's original peoples and owners? This four-part series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project is dedicated to discussing the issues around the federal government's latest attempt to redefine its, and subsequently the Canadian people's, relationship with our Aboriginal neighbors. Part 1 will bring the Indian Act and the current legislation into focus. Part 2 includes a discussion about Native resistance movements and the media's systematically poor coverage of Native issues. Part 3 is dedicated to understanding how the Canadian government's policies have impacted Aboriginal women. And Part 4 will be produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio on this station. Welcome to this final episode of our four-part series on the Canadian government's Aboriginal policy and its impact on our Native neighbors. This episode has been produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center, which is where we will begin tonight, with a short documentary on the Youth Center.
I'm from Val d'Or originally, but my mother's from Mistissini. I've been living in the city for about 5 years, but I've spent most of my younger years in Val d'Or. I've been working here for many years now, about 4 years. The center provides an array of cultural and support services for Aboriginal youth who live in the city. So there's youth from all over the place that come here, a huge diversity, different backgrounds and so forth, between 12 and 29 years of age. I just oversee the programming and give support to the youth and try to motivate them to get involved in different things. Because it's a drop-in center, there's always youth that just come by and just hang out. And a lot of the youth just want to kind of as like a safe haven, you know, being that they're away from their families and their communities. So they come here and they can just hang out with other Aboriginal people. So they feel at ease here and safe. And they need a lot of support too, so that's what we're here for. But we do reach out to the government for financial support, like to get more programming and more money so that we can continue supporting our people. But in terms of, there's no direct relationship, I'd say. I guess I just want to prove that we can handle our own affairs and that we can be sovereign people. And most of the attention we do get is when there's something negative happening and then they want to inquire about it. But in terms of all the great things that we're doing, we'll reach out maybe and we'll send out press conferences if we do something positive. But often it'll be mostly like the Aboriginal medias that will come forth, like APTN has participated in, you know, broadcasting one of our big events and so forth, and The Nation, like it's a Cree magazine, but and CBC North. But in terms of the Gazette and these other mainstream media empires or whatever, but they don't give us that much attention.
Toi, Jean-François, t'es pas intéressé à faire de la radio?
Rien à dire?
Non.
Non?
non.
Pourquoi je veux savoir, monsieur?
Vous, monsieur Martel, vous aimeriez pas ça faire un peu de radio? Vous avez rien à dire?
Ah, bien si, bien si. Il y a beaucoup de choses qui me font réagir dans la vie de tous les jours, mais en ce moment, je suis en train de le diffuser sur Internet et probablement plus tard, je parlerai, diffuserai sur le canal FM.
Merci, Monsieur Martel. Commentaire très pertinent. Puis vous, Monsieur Eric, est-ce que vous aimeriez ça faire la radio? Il n'y a rien qui vous fâche dans la vie? Il n'y a rien qui vous rend heureux?
Qu'est-ce qui me fâche, ça, c'est les filles qui veulent te violer puis t'as pas le choix à cause que tout le monde te pousse dans le cul. Là, tu traverses des toilettes puis ça marche pas, t'es trop énervé. Ça, c'est une terrible chose dans la vie.
OK, est-ce que, mis à part ça, est-ce qu'il y a des choses qui vous rendent heureux?
Ouais, j'aime ça me faire violer aussi, mais faire des belles filles, tu vois.
Très pertinent, oui, très profond à ce que j'ai vu, en tout cas. Merci.
And you, Dan, wouldn't you like to do some radio sometimes?
Yes, I would.
Okay, and is there any subjects you would like to speak about? Anything that gets you angry, makes you happy?
No, not really.
Nothing?
Well, there is. I don't like the idea of a microphone in my face right now.
Oh, okay. And what if you close your eyes?
Maybe that will work.
Okay.
Nope.
Thank you, Dan.
Alright.
And you, Sam?
No.
Thank you. And Jolene?
Nope.
No panic? No radio?
So, only computer.
You just heard the voices of Darlene Wapachi, youth coordinator at Montreal's Native Friendship Center, and Sophie Claude, an animator at the Youth Center, who was interviewing youth as they participated in various activities. If you'd like to check out Montreal's Native Friendship Center, drop by any day of the week. The center is located at 2001 St. Laurent at Ontario in downtown Montreal, or give them a call at 514-499-1854. Next up, an interview with Canada's Department of Indian Affairs. Stay tuned.
Be who you are.
We cannot walk both roads.
Be who you are.
We cannot walk both roads.
Be who you are.
We cannot walk both roads.
And you will know what to do.
Indian people still are portrayed as inarticulate savages.
I'm a dog, a red dog, so what you want? I kick the lyrics that make you stomp. And I'm flaunt and taunt them until the end I'm red and true. So tell a friend they can't change me. I disobey thee, sell my soul, they must be crazy. Cause I'm loud and proud and I'm down to throw down. So check yourself when war comes to town. Cause it ain't no sin to be loud and proud of the skin I'm born in. Skin I'm in, down to win. If you diss, you'll step to a Mac 10. Skin, I'm in, down to win. Don't you step, punk. Cause I'm proud of my skin. Cause I'm proud of the skin I'm in.
I'm MC Heights, the strong red brother. Don't trip, cause I'm down to rape and plunder. Cause they raped our minds and they raped our souls. But it's tough, cause now I'm in control. Now I'm a taker, an Aryan soul raper. Roles reverse, you better rein the hearse. It gets worse with every verse, I'm down to hurt. Do what's wrong and it only makes us strong. So don't get near me, better fear me. I can't stop until you hear me. There's no holding back, no reason to pretend. Yo, check, I'm proud of the skin I'm in.
Cause I'm proud of my skin. Cause I'm proud of the skin I'm in. Cause I'm proud of my skin. Cause I'm proud of the skin I'm in.
Like I said before, like a stick of dynamite. Light a fuse and I might explode in your face. I'll take back my place. Coming up strong, it's a native race. I'm proud of my skin. The thoughts, the hope, the strength that's within. I gotta thank my kin who fought and taught to stay true to the end. Innocence
raps attack, talking about the skin I'm in.
We cannot walk both roads.
Be who you are.
We cannot walk both roads.
Welcome back to this final episode of our four-part series on the Indian Act. Tonight's episode has been produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. The youth were interested in interviewing the Department of Indian Affairs about the Indian Act. After the youth drafted a list of interview questions, we sent them to the Communications Department of Indian Affairs. Unfortunately, the youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center were not available for the time selected by Indian Affairs to do the interview. So we asked Tanya, editor of Canada's only Native youth magazine, to ask the questions for us.
My name is Tanya Willard. I'm from the Shikwapmuk Nation, Shuswap Nation in the interior of BC, and I'm also editor of Redwire Magazine, which is a print magazine that goes across Turtle Island four times a year, which is a vehicle for news, views, and expressions of Native youth.
Oh, well, my name is Barbara Craig. I'm a member of the Oneida Six Nations, and I'm the Director General of Policy Partnership and Coordination, which is a branch of Lands and Trust Services at Indian Affairs.
Okay, great. So I guess my first question is regarding the Indian Act and how it affects education for Native youth who are looking to go to post-secondary school, or even if it affects earlier phases of education.
Okay, the answer to your question is that the Indian Act deals with schools. Section 114 and 122 of the Indian Act deals with schools as distinct from education. For example, Section 114 permits the governor and council to authorize the minister to enter into agreements on behalf of Her Majesty with the provinces and territories for the education of Indian children, and it also permits the minister to establish and operate and maintain schools.
Mm-hmm.
Other sections of the Indian Act deal with, among other things, who must attend school, and it says Indian children between the ages of 7 and 16, but the Indian may be required, the minister may require them to go to school till, or when they're 6, until they're older than 16.
Right.
It deals with truancy and separate day schools or classrooms for minority religious denominations. So you can see it doesn't deal with education specifically. Your question about post-secondary education is based on policy.
Right.
And I'm not the right person to talk to about the post-secondary education.
Right. Okay. I guess then another question I had is, how does the Indian Act impact BAM band membership? Or does it?
It deals with band membership. Sections 8 through 10 of the Indian Act deal with band membership. And Section 8 of the Indian Act requires that the Registrar of Indian Affairs maintain a band list for each band, and this is a quote, in which shall be entered the name of every person who was a member of that band.
Right.
So for the band lists that are controlled by the department, status equals membership. So if you're a status Indian, you get to be on the band list.
Right.
However, under Section 10, which is a very detailed section, has a lot of subsections to it, permits a band to assume control of its membership with the consent of the members of the band. As I said, it's very detailed. There are detailed rules for how it does this.
Right.
And who, basically, the band has to accept whoever is on the departmental list,
mm-hmm,
the day that their own membership rules come into effect. But they can put in other criteria with the net effect that status may no longer equal membership for First Nations that control their own membership.
Right.
And I don't know how many First Nations that is.
Do you control their own band membership? You don't know?
I don't know how many do that.
Okay.
No.
Okay. What is the history of band council governments? When and why were they created? And are they evaluated in any way as to their effectiveness?
Okay. I can tell you that I did a little bit of research so that I can answer your question, because I didn't know how far it went for sure. The earliest reference I could find was in an act in 1876, and it was called An Act to Amend and Consolidate the Laws Respecting Indians. And in Clause 62 of that act, an electoral system was introduced. And as far as I'm concerned, its policy was to further the policy objective, or its purpose, rather, was to further the policy objectives of the government of the day, mm-hmm. which was the civilization, acculturation, and assimilation of Indians. So they wanted them to have governments or to be governments and have elections in the same way that Europeans understood them. And I think that this is borne out because in 1880, the act to which I've just referred was further amended to clarify that in the event that His Excellency had made an order that chiefs of a band would be elected, the life chief or the hereditary chief could not exercise power unless they were also became elected under the electoral provisions.
Right, and that's true of today. Hereditary chiefs are not, unless they win an election.
No, it's actually not. There's subtleties to that because the current Indian Act recognizes two kinds of band councils. It recognizes band councils that have been elected under the Indian Act, and it also recognizes band councils that have been elected by custom.
Right.
So I think there are a few hereditary chiefs. I don't know how many that would be.
Right.
But there are some, and some places where elections aren't held.
And in what, like you talked about the objectives of the early setting up the band council governments, and how do you think that's changed today?
Well, I would say that the whole policy of the federal government has changed today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're no longer talking about those same policy objectives.
Right.
I mean, I would say with the self-government initiatives recognizing inherent right to self-government and all of that, it's a very different picture.
Okay. And I guess I had this question was the one you found a bit confusing, but let me just try and clarify it.
Okay.
I was wondering about the different levels of government that if you live on reserve, you have to deal with. I realize there's a number of different situations, but is it basically the provincial and federal? Or?
Well, I mean, if you were the band council, if you were an individual on the reserve, you have to deal with your band government.
Yeah.
You have to deal, in some cases, perhaps with the provincial government. For example, if you wanted to get a driver's license or a health card or something, because the provinces provide health services. And if you are a status Indian, of course, which probably are if you're living on reserve, then there are programs and services and things that come from the federal government. But if you're talking about, for example, the example that was given in the original question I saw was about economic development.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to be involved in something economic development, then you probably would only have to deal with, if it was on reserve, with the federal government.
Right.
Having said that, the reason I say that is because there's Section 88 of the Indian Act that says that provincial laws of general application apply to Indians, but it doesn't say land reserve for Indians. And the courts have held that it doesn't, that general laws or provincial laws of general application don't apply to lands.
Right.
So if you were going to use the land for something or an economic development process, you're probably dealing with the federal government. But having said that, I mean, I think that there are the provincial government might be involved in some of those processes.
Sure.
But I don't really know what they would be exactly.
But in general, if you're undertaking some kind of initiative on reserve, you're basically going to expect to deal with three levels of government, the band council government, provincial possibly, and federal government.
Yes. And if you are the band government, then I think you can expect to deal with the federal government and or the provincial government, depending what you're talking about. Because the provincial government, I think, does give funding to First Nations for some things. It depends where you are.
Mm-hmm. And at any point, I know in some of our old legislation or things like that, the Indian Act and stuff, there's still reference to the Queen and the monarchy. Would that ever come into play in a situation, just land claims issues or
No.
Okay.
Not anymore. We have the Queen and right of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, she's there, but it's not the same.
Right. Okay, and the federal government at this point is not commenting on the referendum being held in B.C.?
I'm not commenting on it.
Okay. Does the federal government...
know, you might be able to find somebody who would, but it certainly wouldn't be me.
Right. Is there any information on the federal government's website or anything like that? Any kind of official statement?
I don't know, Tanya.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the website. I don't know. There might... I don't know.
Okay. And this is the last question, was around why reserves are called reserves, and you mentioned that you weren't sure where that originally came from.
No. I was reading through some historical stuff, and I saw a reference by one of the treaty commissioners in a letter in 1844 and talking about reserves.
Right.
And I don't know why.
I'm just going to... I had a few other questions that I thought of during the interview, so if you don't mind, I just...
You can ask them. I don't
sure,
know if I can
you,
answer them.
Sure, no problem. I was just wondering, you mentioned that you're First Nations. I was just wondering what, if you know of the general division of employment, how many First Nations people are employed in the Ministry of Indian Affairs?
I just saw some statistics recently, and they're escaping me.
Okay.
I don't know.
Do you know?
I know
if it,
there's a target.
Right. What's the target?
50%.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. If it is 50%.
Yeah, but I think I'm safe in saying we're not there.
Right.
But
right.
I don't know where we are.
Is it? Do you know if there's a projected timeline on that goal?
No.
Okay. And I guess then I just have a personal question.
Okay.
In that, as a First Nations person. What is it like working within the ministry? Do you find yourself in conflict positions ever, or?
I wouldn't say that I'm in conflict
mm-hmm.
With anybody. I think that sometimes, I mean, the goals and or things of the federal government are what I'm. I have to be here and I have to do what, you know,
mm-hmm.
what's expected and all of that. And there are times when. I would have done it personally. I would have done it differently.
Right.
But one can say sometimes it's a bit schizophrenic.
Right. And what is it like when you're talking to your own reserve or your own band council and stuff? Is there...
Sometimes it's pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It depends what the file you're dealing with is at the
right.
time.
Right.
But for the most part, we're pretty respectful of each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's... all the other questions, although I did have a quick question about the state of the Indian Act, and if there was, recently the federal government was, I think, planning to do some changes or some re...
Yeah, there's a First Nations Governance Initiative underway right now,
mm-hmm.
and that's an initiative of the Minister of Indian Affairs, and he's interested in looking at the possibility of amending the Indian Act. Not, I shouldn't say amending the Indian Act, but because it's not clear that there would be amendments.
Right.
That decision of whether it would be amendments or whether it would be a new piece of legislation hasn't been made as far as I'm aware.
Right.
There have been quite extensive consultations across the country and talking about the core governance issues like accountability,
mm-hmm.
both financial and political accountability, about legal status and capacity and authorities of
right.
First Nations councils, and leadership selection. So the consultations are finished. They finished towards the end of November,
right.
December.
Yep.
The consultation report has come out. I just recently, in fact, or this week, I think, the minister is sending out to all chiefs and councils a summary of what we found out during the consultations.
Right.
All in all, there were almost 400 consultation sessions across the country.
Despite the boycott?
Yep.
Right.
And about 10,000 people participated either by attending one of the meetings or by filling out a questionnaire and either mailing it in or filling it out on the Internet.
Right.
So right now the minister has created a joint ministerial advisory committee, and that committee he has asked for their technical advice based on the consultations and their own views of what the amendments should be in those three core areas that I've just outlined.
Right. And that committee is made up of First Nations, or is it?
Some First Nations. There are representatives from some of the national organizations, and then there are some departmental representatives, and then there are some people who are just who were chosen because of their particular expertise. For example, Jim Eldridge, he was the negotiator or the legal counsel, I forget which, for the NISCA in their recent land claim.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some representatives from the Department of Justice.
Right.
Did I say some from the department, too? Yeah, there were some from the department.
Right. And so after the report is released, what's the next step from there for the First Nations Governance Act?
Okay, well, once the Joint Ministerial Advisory Committee gives the minister their advice, then the minister will be making decisions about what should be in the legislation and how to proceed.
Right. And if there is a legislation proposed,
mm-hmm.
It goes through the federal house?
Yeah, through the parliament. Yeah.
Right, parliament.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's all the questions
okay.
I had. So thank you.
You're welcome, Tanya. It was a pleasure. Oh, can you just hang on for 1 second?
Sure.
The man from communications who's here has got a question. I would like to speak to you for a minute.
Sure.
Okay. Her name's Tanya.
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, who am I speaking to?
Tanya Willard. I'm the editor of Redwire, Native Youth Magazine.
Okay. How do you spell your last name, Tanya?
W-I-L-L-A-R-D.
Okay. I thought we were doing the interview with Gretchen, but that's fine. Sounded pretty good, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and you are the editor again of?
Redwire Magazine.
Redwire?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Okay.
But I'd love to hear about it. Can you send us a copy?
Sure.
That was Mike Murphy from the Communications Department of Indian Affairs. You were just listening to a conversation between Tanya Willard and Barbara Craig. Barbara works with the Department of Indian Affairs, and Tanya Willard is the editor of Canada's only Native Youth Magazine. You can find Redwire Magazine on the web at redwiremag.com. That's redwiremag.com. You can also reach him by phone at area code 604-602-7226. That's 604-602-7226. Stay tuned. Up next, we have a conversation between Donovan Brass from Montreal's Native Friendship Center and Jonathan Kay, a journalist in the National Post.
Native Americans are here today to issue a wake-up call to all of us.
Tribes are now working back.
Tribes are now working back.
Native Americans are here today to issue a wake-up call to all of us.
Tribes are now working back.
Tribes are now working back.
It's about time. They broke out of the mindset, but you know the devil never has regret. Cause about 502 years ago, the devil's king tried to make everyone they hold. But you know we ain't down for slavery, and it seems like the Bible would say, let us be. Instead, they took the words straight from the Lord and said, take a land by hook, crook, or by the sword. Now they got a deal, the issue is real. After 502 years, here's how I feel. They tried to take us out, but they couldn't. The law say peace, but I shouldn't. Instead, I'll pump the lead directed at the heads. And once inside, there'll be no place to run and hide. I can't stop the flow, I gotta kick this. Here's what you get after 502 years of wickedness.
Native Americans are here today to issue a wake-up call to all of us.
502 years.
502
years.
Come on. Native Americans are here today to issue a wake-up call to all of us in this country.
502 years.
Wake up, wake up. They can never hide the lies from me. And they call this the land of opportunity. If it's true, then why is it so? They hide the past, deny the truth. They don't want the world to know that America is built on greed. Whatever you see, just take. Yeah, you got the need. This country's great. If you like to kill, steal, or rape, there's some land. Damn, they're on the take again. Then they ask why I have this attitude. After 502 years, you'd be kinda rude. So here's some proof of thought. We can't be bought or sold out. Consider me the ultimate holdout. Cause we're staying true
and was staying strong. After 502 years, we can't be wrong. So I gotta give props to my people. They survived 502 years of evil.
In this country, we as Native people find out we are not as free as we think we are.
502 years. 502.
We are not as free as we think we are.
502 years of wickedness and evil.
That this has got to end, though.
Okay, Jonathan, or Mr. K. Mr. K?
Call me Jonathan.
Jonathan? Okay. Jonathan, where were you educated?
I went to high school in Quebec. I went to CEGEP at Marianopolis. I did Bachelor's of Engineering at McGill, and then I did a Master's of Engineering at McGill. And then I studied law at Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay. Have you studied journalism at all or taken any classes on journalism?
No. I was a professional lawyer, and I switched straight from law into journalism.
Okay. Did you take any classes on Native issues whatsoever while you were attending university at any of these places?
No. I was my academic background was in engineering. Like a lot of subjects, I started studying it as a journalist.
Okay. Have you lived in or around any Native communities?
Only in Montreal, which, as you know, is surrounded by Native lands.
Okay. Have you ever visited any of those Native communities?
Yes. In Canada and also in Australia.
Okay. Can you tell me about your experiences while you visited these communities? A little bit about it.
I saw what a lot of other visitors saw. I was, alarmed by the alcoholism. I was alarmed by the lack of employment. I was greatly saddened by it. I thought it was completely inhumane that a segment of developed nation would live in that way. Experience actually caused me to be interested in the subject, which is why I've written about it as a journalist.
Okay, and was that your first encounter with a Native person is when you went to visit these communities when you did this?
No, study? I mean, I started visiting Native areas in 1990.
Okay.
And this was after I had been at McGill already for a couple of years.
So was that during the Oka crisis then?
The Oka crisis unfolded around that time. But I had already met plenty of Aboriginal people at McGill. McGill has a reasonably sizable Aboriginal population. But it was around 1990, 1991 that I actually started to visit Aboriginal areas.
Okay, and was that just for social gatherings or just out of interest, personal interest? Or?
Well, I traveled. Actually, it started when I traveled around Australia, and I was in a four-wheel drive vehicle with some colleagues, engineering colleagues, and we visited some areas of Australia that were primarily Aboriginal, and that's where I started to become interested, because that's where I first became appalled at the state of Aboriginal communities in Western countries.
Okay. Can you tell me about the special project the National Post assigned you to?
Yeah, the National Post was interested in looking at creative solutions to the Aboriginal problem in Canada. And when I say Aboriginal problem, I mean the alcoholism, the high employment rate, the high welfare dependence, the high level of domestic abuse that you see in Aboriginal areas. I was assigned the project of finding what I thought was a solution that made sense and without regard toward the political correct orthodoxies that tend to surround the issue. And the product of this was, you saw it.
I'm afraid I didn't read it. Just briefly kind of scanned over it.
Okay. Well, that was the December 8th essay that appeared in the National Post,
okay.
The review section of the National Post.
Okay. Can you tell me why you were selected for this project?
I guess because it was a highly analytical project. I'm on the editorial board. I write a lot of what could be called essay journalism. That is, journalistic pieces that are aimed at advancing a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The piece was printed in the National Post as an essay. It wasn't presented as a piece of objective reportage, and so they were looking for someone who had experience with writing that sort of journalism, opinion journalism, comment journalism.
Okay, and can you tell me, how did you go about approaching your research?
Well, I called contacts that I had made in my casual observation of the issue, particularly in Australia. And like in all sorts of journalistic projects, that sort of snowballs. You start with a small radius of people, maybe half dozen or so, and then after you interview them, you put to them the question, who do you really admire in this field? Who knows their stuff in this field? Who has really interesting ideas in the field? And they give you names, and you sort of radiate outward from a small group of people until you've talked to dozens and dozens of experts.
So you're saying that you started with basically personal friends and colleagues? Is that
not just personal friends, people whose work I was aware of just from being a reader of books. And, you know, for instance, in Canada, there's Tom Flanagan, who appears in our newspaper, Gail Valskakis, who's head of the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, which is located in Ottawa. She was very helpful. People in Australia who I cite in my article, a guy by the name of Gary Johns, who's produced a book. Many of these are people who I became aware of from reading their books. And I go on the internet and find contact information for them, and I just call them and I say, "Can I interview you?" And typically, they were very forthcoming because it's a subject that they want to talk about.
Okay. And did you try to find people with opposing viewpoints on all these issues that you're describing?
Yeah. I mean, that's it. It wouldn't have been a very interesting article if I didn't present the opposing view. And I quote, I cite some of those people in the article. I talked to some Aboriginal band leaders. I talked to some academics who are active in the field, and Gail Valskakis herself, who declined to be interviewed, but she has a different view from my own, and Robert De Gagne, who's worked for the government. I spoke with two or three former officers of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples who had radically different viewpoints than my own.
Okay. Can you tell me, describe to me what you believe the roots of these social problems you mentioned in your essay? Can I refer to it just as an essay then?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think the big policy problem in Canada is we haven't decided whether we are going to try and preserve Aboriginal culture or whether we are going to try and enrich Aboriginal people, because the goals, I believe, are mutually exclusive. If you want to keep Aboriginal reserves in a cultural clamshell and try and protect them as distinct, protected cultures, similar to the cultures we found when we colonized North America, then that's one thing. If you're going to try and bring these people into the modern economy, complete with computers and television and internet access and suit and tie jobs, you know, that's another. The problem in Canada is we want to do both, and what I argue in the essay is that the two goals are incompatible.
Okay, do you believe that the problems you're describing right now, that they may stem from the appropriation of native land, which in effect crippled the economic base in those communities?
Well, I mean, you know, the problem with Aboriginal communities, I don't think there's a lack of land. There are many bands in Canada and...
Well, I'm talking about, like, their ability to use the land. As I believe as it stands now, they're not, unless they get permission to... permission from Indian Affairs, and that takes 20 different papers, and those papers may take up to a year, and business just does not work at that pace.
You're quite right. That the way land is structured on Aboriginal reserves is a big problem. The way businessmen in our society typically get capital to create businesses is they go out and mortgage their property. So, for instance, let's say I wanted to start, say, a pizzeria or something. The first thing I'd probably do is I'd mortgage my home, because that way that's the way you get money in our society. You can't mortgage property on an Indian reserve. And the reason you can't mortgage property is because that would give the possibility of surrendering that property to a bank or another financial institution. But because we have a cultural clamshell policy, we don't want these lands to come out of of Indian ownership. We don't let them mortgage their properties because we're afraid, you know, we don't want to break up the Indian cultural character of the reservation. by not allowing them to mortgage their lands, we deprive them of the ability to get capital to start businesses. So you're right. You know, the land, the way we manage land on Indian...
And also just basically, how about them just being able to access the resources that are on the land as it stands? Like, I think that's also... Would you believe that's also a problem?
I think...
It's like, for example, lumber, minerals, water, those things I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, but the problem is you have to define what your goal is. Like, you know, the best example is the Caiopo Indians in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, you know, everyone wanted to keep loggers and miners out of the Caiopo lands. And they said, you know, these are Caiopo lands. And as soon as you start exploiting the resources, you know, the tribe is going to lose control, and you're going to, you know, you're going to kill off the native community. So what happened was the Caiopo chiefs were given, you know, total control of the logging and mining rights. And the first thing they did was they sold out to the mining and logging companies, and they got a lot of money. I mean, what happens when you give Indian bands control of the mineral and lumber resources? They typically make a lot of cash. I mean, there's no question. The problem is that cash ends up being squandered typically by the band leadership.
The National Post often runs stories on how corrupt native communities are, but why is there no mention that Canada set up those corrupt band councils? And are you aware that the band councils are not traditional governments?
I have no problem with getting rid of the band councils. I agree. I mean, I think it's a totally flawed system. They're corrupt. They're nepotistic. There's absolutely no question that it's a bad way to run things. The problem is, what's the alternative? If the alternative is traditional leadership, well, what are the traditions of typical hunter-gatherer bands? They tend to be patriarchal. They tend to be ancestral-based. They tend to be, in other words, profoundly undemocratic. If you have a mode of governance that's based on your lineage and based on your gender, I can't think of anything more undemocratic.
I'm not actually absolutely sure that that's the case. I think it was, if you take, for example, Iroquois, the Great Peace, as an example, that to me was a very democratic method where people of each village got their say by one representative, and that every person got to get heard in a larger setting. But academia has been mulling over this question for more than 100 years of the native issue, and you came to your conclusion in 8 months. Can you tell me how that's so?
Well, the problem, if I had 100 years, I would have taken the 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, very few of us have 100 years, because if I started now, I'd be 130 by the time I finished.
Right, but I'm just wondering, like, academia has tried to address this issue for more than 100 years, and you've come to an absolute concrete conclusion from what it appears in 8 months, and I'm wondering how, like, what is your premise for your argument?
The problem is, you look at those 100 years, I mean, so much of that time, academics were laboring under profoundly racist concepts. I mean, until relatively recently, academics were operating under the completely false and poisonous assumption that Aboriginal people were stupid and that there was nothing to be done with them because, you know, they were genetically inferior. And then, you know, relatively recently, we got rid of that sort of bigotry. But then, unfortunately, we got locked into a politically correct mindset. And if you look at a lot of the Canadian scholarship that's been produced in the last 20 or 30 years, it's not worth reading, because it's just sort of a set of politically correct slogans about how bad white people are and how inherently peaceful and wise.
So are you basically saying that when you say it's not worth reading, are you saying that you haven't read any of these articles over the past 30 years?
I'm saying if you read it, okay, if you go out and read it, you'll find a lot of it is not worth reading. You'll say, mm-hmm, I just read 200 pages that taught me very little, except that the writer doesn't want to offend any new people.
Then it's safe to say that you never included any of these people's opinions in your article?
I quote them. I often, in several cases in the article, I quote them as being representative of a sort of viewpoint that I find not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are whole books, like I've got, I mean, I'm looking at my bookshelf now, there's a whole row of books, and often they're very beautifully written homage to a mode of thinking that is very politically correct, is very sympathetic to Aboriginal interests, but as I argue in my essay, a lot of it is not helpful, because you end up pursuing the same kind of conclusion. Give more money to the Aboriginals, give more rights. You know, that looks good on paper. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is the money ends up feeding corrupt bands. Unemployment skyrockets, welfare dependence skyrockets, you break down traditional family structures, and the $7 billion that we're spending on Aboriginal reservations, this is $70,000 per family on average, you go to these reservations and it ends up looking like a third world.
Okay. So how many Native communities have you studied in Canada here to make that conclusion? I believe there's 80 communities and
there's
maybe two or three bands.
Yeah. There's over 600 communities.
So how many out of those did you go and visit and actually were able to come to this conclusion?
In terms of, like we were talking about 100 years, to see all 600 would take...
How many did you see, though, is what I guess I'm asking.
A couple of dozen. But that's not even just in Canada. That's counting also.
I mean just in Canada. Because you're talking about Native peoples here in Canada, I believe.
I couldn't give you an exact figure because you're going back 10 years.
Oh, okay. Now, when you're suggesting to assimilate Native people, what are you assimilating them to?
You're assimilating them into a industrialized, urban, English or French-speaking, depending on which part of Canada you happen to be in, Western culture.
Okay, can you just tell me what that culture is?
Sure, that culture is...
Is it like Big Macs and poutine, or is it watching Everybody Loves Raymond, or can you tell me what this culture is?
Well, the current manifestation of our culture tends to be, yes, a mass media culture... That is based on cities or towns. That is connected by an electrical and grid, by a paved road grid, by a media grid. Connected by telephones, and where people work in either service industry or manufacturing industry. And they are not dependent on the government for the necessities of life.
Okay. And when you suggest this, so I guess then you mean all other minorities should be assimilated too? So you're saying, because I think you said everybody should be. Am I misquoting you? Are you saying like people that are of Hindu descent should not wear their traditional clothes and should give up their culture and their religion and be assimilated into mainstream Canadian English and French culture?
Actually, when you cite the Hindu example, it's actually probably one of the very best examples of assimilation into Canadian society. We've had a wave of Indian assimilation, of Indian immigration.
So, that's what you're arguing for, is assimilation of all minority cultures into...
Let me finish. The Hindu experience in Canada is, or North America, I should say, in the middle part of the century, there was a rather large migration of Hindu South Asians to North America. The first generation was sort of captured by the stereotype you see on The Simpsons with Apu. They opened up convenience stores and they worked hard. And now you're seeing the second and third generation of Indians. And a lot of them are accountants and doctors and lawyers. And many of them speak Hindi, many of them don't. The point is they have become completely assimilated into our Western capitalist system. They're fluent English speakers. They make a lot of money. Their average income is very high. So that model of assimilation, I find obviously to be economically productive. Yes.
So it's fair for me to state then that you would like all minorities to be assimilated into the mainstream culture.
It wouldn't be fair to do that. And if you do say that, I'll sue you. I'm taking the conversation. So don't say that.
I'm just asking you then. What communities get excluded from being assimilated into the mainstream culture then?
Economic assimilation means what I've told you economic assimilation is. In terms of the language you speak at home, in terms of the God you pray to, in terms of the food you eat,
that's part of, you just then, I don't understand, that sounds contrary. When Native people are eating their traditional food, you just said that people can eat the food that they want.
You aren't listening to me. You can work 9 to 5. You can live in a completely industrialized urban society. When you go home, you can eat whatever food you like. It doesn't matter to me, and it shouldn't matter to you.
Okay, so what if these Native people are working 9 to 5 and then they decide to go hunting after work or on the weekend?
But if you work in an urban environment, if you want to take the weekend off, go in your Lincoln Navigator and go out and hunt, sure, you can do it. The point of my article was that there's a certain economic mode of existence that surrounds a hunting-gathering society.
So you're saying that Native people then... you're not arguing for assimilation of their culture,
of
their beliefs, or of the way they live, they choose to live their life?
You and I are arguing past each other because we're using different definitions of culture.
Okay, well, can you explain to me what your definition is then?
If you talk about food and the way people dress, those are sort of the superficial trappings of culture. I mean, every society has different kinds of foods. Every society has different kinds of dress. That is one aspect of culture, but I would say it's a relatively superficial aspect of culture. In terms of the deeper aspects of culture, how do you organize your society? Are you a hunter-gatherer society, or are you an industrialized society? Do you organize your government according to democracy, like we do, or do you use a patriarchal, ancestral-based mode of governance, like typically hunter-gatherer tribes do? Fundamental questions about the organization of societies. That goes to what a profound definition of culture.
Okay, can you tell me then how you would believe would be the right or correct route to go about assimilating Native people into mainstream culture?
The best way to assimilate Aboriginals into mainstream culture would be to stop economically encouraging them to live on rural Bantustans. So, for instance, Aboriginals don't pay any income tax.
That's on reserves only, right? And then
exactly.
You just said there's no economics going on there, so I guess that's not very useful then.
It's not very useful because you're encouraging them to live on these Bantustans. They're not connected.
Well, no,
to
I mean, if they don't pay taxes, I mean, if there's no economic base, I mean, it's not very useful.
I would say that in order to encourage them to get off those Bantustans, exempt them from income tax in cities. I mean, if that's what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what it takes to get these people into cities, into economically productive jobs, and to stop collecting welfare and reserves, sure, get them.
Are you aware of how many Native people are actually in urban settings?
It's about 50%.
Okay.
It's about 50% of the registered Aboriginal population, and on average, they do a lot better economically than the ones who stay in the reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage that exodus to continue. Why?
So you want all Native people to leave their traditional lands and to move into the city and get 9-to-5 jobs?
Yeah, that's fair.
What do you think of the Native Youth Movement?
Explain to me what the Native Youth Movement is.
In your research, you've never come across that?
I've come across plenty of terms, but they're always often defined differently by different people. What do you mean by Native Youth Movement?
Basically, for the keeping the treaties as they stand, trying to keep the culture as it stands.
Well, I mean, you know, this is a pattern you see in a lot of societies, is that the younger you are, and the less you are connected with the actual business of making money and raising a family, the more idealistic you are. If you're a college student, the idea of maintaining your culture exactly how it is or exactly how it was 500 years ago sounds great. Once you're actually raising a family and you see your kids are sniffing glue and you see that you can't get proper health care and you see that you're in a community full of all sorts of pathologies such as domestic abuse, that ideology starts to look pretty bad. So it doesn't surprise me that you do see young people who have a sort of a militant affection for an extreme desire to protect what they imagine to be Aboriginal culture. Ask them in 10 or 15 years what they think of that, and I think you'll get very different answers.
Okay, well, Jonathan, I think that's about all the questions that we have here tonight. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak with me.
My pleasure.
Resurrection of the jaguar, kind of take my throne. Before assuming a holy see, one must first atone. I once lived, I said, before I knew the powers of the mind. Thoughts combined to blow up like landmines. Master of my destiny, slave to no system. In the morning when I rise, the only lie I know is wisdom. I harvest hip hop, you know the most up on the crop. Although the rain's diminished, still I know that I will not. Like the food that feeds the needy, my sustenance is needy. Refuse to take the fight because my nature isn't greedy. You see me? Express my anger through graffiti, tagging bricks in Manhattan cause they stole it in the treaty. Revolution of the conscious mind, aided by the conscious rhyme. My conscious line lets you know the conscious time. The government is doing battles with the mind, and in my mentor you will find that the wise will always shine.
Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise. Look up to the Father, fi make my way. In this Babylon society, it's hard again. Live up fi me family, live up fi me name. Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise. Look up to the Father, fi make my way. In this Babylon society, it's hard again. Live up fi me family, live up fi me name.
The conscious 1, 2, 3. 4-5% everlasting concepts, tropolis for no relent. Cause I will never quit as long as we are one. That we're strong as a million trees from the last attack. Severed at the root so they could build a wall of Babylon. Fate remains strong, tribalism carries on. There's two types of people in this world that I can name. There's tribalism.
scientists and scientists are scientists for gain. The tribalist mentality is content with itself, while a scientific mindset is all about the wealth. A tribalist teacher will offer you knowledge, while a scientific preacher try to force you to college, force you to their world to be just like them. When they all look the same, they turn their back on their friend. A scientist should know the tribalist motivation, to know that they could never truly conquer such a nation.
Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise, look up to the Father, we make my way. In this Babylon society, it's all a game. Live up for me family, live up for me name. Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise, look up to the Father, we make my way. In this Babylon society, it's all a game. Live up for me family, live up for me name.
Assimilation, a concept brought by the devil. Toxic melted pots as a people were metal. This is one nation, considered indivisible. The nation is divided into groups, it's quite visible. For some of these groups, it's liberty and justice. Still, for most tribes, these things are fictitious. A scientist is empty, stealing his culture from others. Stole cause he never asked my African brothers. In these present days, it's the same old sagas. Was there no red man with the first founding fathers? Wait a minute, I'll explain my conclusion. What they tried to copy was the Mohawk Constitution, to satisfy the great monetary need. They changed a few things so they could feed the greed. Then as a twist, a last act of defiance, they denied our knowledge of the Five Nations Alliance.
Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise, look up to the Father, we make my way. In this Babylon society, it's all a game. Live up for me family, live up for me name. Wake up early morning, give thanks and praise, look up to the Father, we make my way. In this Babylon society, it's all a game. Live up for me family, live up for me name.
That concludes this episode of this four-part series on the Indian Act. Thanks to the youth at Montreal's Native Friendship Center and Darlene and Sophie for all of their assistance. Thanks to all the contributors who have participated in this four-part series on the Indian Act. If you're looking for copies of tapes or CDs of this four-part series, you can contact the CKUT News Department at 514-398-6787, extension 2593. That's 514-398-6787. 6787 extension 2593. Or you can send us email, news@ckut.ca. That's news@ckut.ca. This has been a presentation of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project, where we move beyond the headlines and the sound bites and get to the real issues.
Never hear it.